since we've been away for a few weeks, I'm going to summarize the parts that are relevant to what we're going to be learning now. The Rav talks about two covenants. One where the Torah describes that as a bris, that's the bris of Sinai. And the other, which the Torah never explicitly says is a bris, but the Rav assumes is a bris, is the Tzias Mitzrayim. And he sees the bris of Mitzrayim, the covenant of Egypt, as a covenant of faith, of Jews that shared the same faith in Egypt and were saved. And that leads to a sense of solidarity amongst the Jewish people, sharing of experiences, sharing of concern for each other, and a level of devotion to each other. The second covenant is that of Har Sinai, and that's of course Kabbalah HaTorah. And that every Jew keeps the Torah or accepts the notion of Kabbalah HaTorah, and that the Rav defines as a covenant of destiny, or Yehud in Hebrew, that what we are meant to do as a people in this world through life of Torah. When the Rav says things philosophically, he tries to root them in something halachic. I mentioned it's going to come up again in something else, and hopefully I'll get to it in a few minutes. So the Rav points out that the Rambam, he describes the Jews accepting the Torah as a form of geirus, of a conversion. And it appears from the Rambam that it consisted of two parts. One was the part that had to be done in Mitzrayim, and that is Bris Milah. The Jews had to do a Bris Milah before they could bring the Korban Pesach. That was in Mitzrayim, and they went to Milah, Amayim at Har Sinai. And the Rav builds on this to differentiate between the role of Milah in conversion and the role of Tzvilah. Milah he sees as a form of Jewish identification or rejection of non-Jewish world, of non-Jewishness. And Tzvilah is associated with Tahara and Kedusha, with acceptance of mitzvahs. And the Rav even suggests that there was no tefillah in Mitzrayim for men. There had to be for women, because otherwise there was nothing. They didn't have mitzvah. I won't go beyond that, but the Rav analyzes in greater depth, giving further proofs of the different stages. But conceptually, the notion is that there's two aspects of the geirus reflected by Milah and Tzvilah, which becomes that the convert, after going back to the conversion of all the Jewish people, now we're talking about individual converts, has to accept both parts. Milah indicating of separating the convert from the non-Jewish world and accepting being part of the Jewish people. And the tefillah is accepting the old mitzvahs, the obligation to keep mitzvahs associated with tefillah and kedusha. And that's the famous sentence in Rus, ki amech ami velokayach elokoi, that Rus says to Naomi, I will join your people is my people, and your God is my God. Both components. Okay. Now, chapter 10 deals with our responsibilities and our failures to accomplish our responsibilities. The Rav assumes, based on what he's built up, that the responsibility on Orthodox Jews and specifically religious Zionists who accept fully this double covenant, right? One should have expressed itself in concern and involvement to protect the physical survival of Jewish people, and secondly, to try to raise their religious and Jewish consciousness. So, and remember that the beginning of Kol Dodi Dofek was focused on tragedy, on Iyov, by implication the Holocaust. And so the Rav starts off by pointing out that we fail in our obligation to the covenant of faith in not being there for the Jews in Europe who were killed out by the Nazis. Not that the Rav can establish, because no one can know, that if somehow we did more, we would have saved more lives. Can never know. But we certainly should have shown greater concern and involvement. So that's why he talks about mournful thoughts of confession. First simple question, do we not sin with respect to the first covenant, the covenant of share fate, with regard to obligation to participate in the pain of the nation, to see and feel suffering? He said, then he witnessed their burdens. Let us be honest, during the terrible Holocaust, the American Jewish community did not rise to the occasion. But, well, we did not properly sense the suffering of the nation. It precious little to save our unfortunate brethren. It's hard to know what we could have accomplished had we been more active. I personally think we could have saved many. No doubt, however, if we had properly felt the pain of our brothers, had we raised our voices and shaken worlds, that Roosevelt issue a sharp warning of protest accompanied by action, we would have been able to significantly slow the process of mass destruction, which of course would have saved lives, because the process ended when the war ended, and we know that a significant percentage of Hungarian Jews managed to survive the Holocaust, because the Germans conquered Hungary very late in the war. They simply didn't have enough time, and their military situation had deteriorated to kill as many as they would have wanted. Right? Okay. So why did we fail? And he says, because everybody, right? I think it's because our sense of nationhood was damaged. We did not grasp the notion of the experience of shared fate and the essence of peoplehood. We're missing the attribute of loving kindness of chesed that Iyov at first also lacked. He ties again what he said about Iyov, that the end of the story of Iyov, even though Iyov is described as a righteous person who fear of God, but he was concerned with his own family and he didn't show great concern for others in the broader sense, and we lack that. Now, this is all going to turn out to be very relevant to deal with Israel. Right? The Jew in Golos, even though we retain the notion of being the Jewish people, but we can't have the same sense of peoplehood when we're spread out all over the world, right? We don't have a central location, we don't have a country. There's no country, there's no government, there's nothing uniting us as one. And therefore there is a diminution of the notion of three people. The Rav is only saying this to get to the other side. And the other side is going to be, well, what are our obligations now that we have a state and have a greater sense of nations. Then we certainly should be doing much more. Again, as I pointed out a number of times, Kol Dedi Dofek was a rabbinic tour given in 1956. In 1956, the state of Israel had a fraction of the people it had now. It did not have the strongest army in the Middle East by any stretch of the imagination. It was facing clear existential threats. Even as late as 1967, prior to the war, and that I was much older, and I certainly remember well, the sense of threat was of a second Holocaust, of being annihilated. Clearly, thank God, the opposite occurred, but that was the sense that people had at that time. So much more so in the early years of the state, where the population was much smaller, the Israeli army was, you know, didn't have serious weapons, and the threat was far greater. So the Rebbe is going to take this and say, we now have a second opportunity not to undo the past, we can't undo the past, but to react differently to the challenge that the Jewish people are going to face, right? It's not identical, but it's 1956, Israel is a very dangerous place. The Jews, referring to the Jews in America in particular, not being personally feeling the threat, but similarly during the Holocaust, the Jews in America had no personal sense of the threat. Clearly, the America was at war, but that was a different threat entirely. And that certainly didn't, remember, American wars, the last time the American war was fought on American territory was the Civil War. It was fighting ourselves. America's always been fighting wars somewhere else, which meant it was very dangerous for the soldiers, but for the people at home, the war was not directly experienced, and they didn't even have, you know, cable news to describe wars every day. So, Rav said, we failed. Now's the second chance. And here where the Rav says something, as I mentioned, when the Rav develops something, he shows it as halakhic sources. He now develops something which, frankly, has proven to be very controversial, and I might even say problematic, and I have evidence that the Rav wouldn't have followed through on. The Rav quotes his father, and it's interesting he quotes his father. Remember, his father passed away in 41. So it's unlikely that his father said this. He didn't say it in response to the Holocaust. It may have had the rise of Nazi Germany already there when he said it. That I don't know. But certainly it was before anybody knew anything. And he passed away. But it's a pshat in the Rambam, but it has all kinds of ramifications. We know halachically that there are two separate mitzvahs which require Jews to destroy an enemy. One is the Shivas Ha'amimim, the seven nations that lived in Canaan before we came, and the other is Amalek, right? Only 5-6 weeks since Parshas Amalek. Now, the Gemara, and there are other halachos that relate to the origins of people, what countries they came from. So, for example, Ammon and Moab, if it's a male, they cannot, even if they convert, they can't marry a Jewish person, but if it's a female, they can. If they come from Egyptians or Edomites, the third generation they can marry in. So the Gemara says none of this is relevant anymore, because when Sanherib came, part of the military strategy of the Babylonians was to take the native population and relocate them in different countries, so that they didn't have the original people anywhere fighting to get their revenge against the Babylonians, right? It was a military strategy. The consequences of it is, right, we no longer can say that any individual, even though he, let's say, he lives in the territory of Mitzrayim, we can't call him an Egyptian for this halachic purposes. It's a machlokis. The Gemara, this is still with Rabbi Akiva, with someone who came from Egypt too. Thought that it did apply to him, but this is the halach. That being the case, so all these mitzvot that deal with people coming from these different people lose their applicability. It can't be applied because we don't know who comes from where, right? So it doesn't exist anymore, right? Because you can't fulfill the mitzvot, you can't fulfill where anybody came from, right? So the Rambam, when he talks about the Shivas Ha'amimim, says the mitzvah to destroy the Shivas Ha'amimim is no longer relevant, because we no longer have the Shivas Ha'amimim, because people are mixed up. But he doesn't say that when it comes to the destruction of Amalek. And as the Rabbi, the Pasuk says, Mechama Hashem Ba'amalek Midor Dor. Apparently, the struggle against Amalek is ongoing. But Sancheirev treated the people from Amalek the same way treat everyone else. Say, Haman, Pasuk says Agog, right, that he came from Agog. So the Rav's father said that Amalek doesn't necessarily mean people who genetically come from Amalek. It refers to any people, nation, that has the mentality of Amalek. And so, for example, the Nazis who wanted to kill out all the Jews, according to this, had the status of Amalek. I won't go into the technical details of the different aspects of the mitzvah, but that's the thing that the Rav quotes the name of his father, and then he applies it to the act. Right? The sense that that Nasser, right, we can figure at that time, spoke about wiping out the Jewish people. Right? So you come out, according to this, that there's still a war against Amalek. Now, why do I say it's very controversial and problematic? Because think of the implications. The implications are that when Israel fights against the Arabs, they can fight like they're fighting Amalek. Right? Amalek can kill man, woman, and child. Right? Assume a whole nation not to destroy you. Now, so maybe the Rav thinks that way. Why am I so sure that the Rav himself doesn't think that way? Because during the first Lebanon War, there was the massacre of Palestinians by Christian Arabs from Lebanon in the camps of Sabra and Shatila. And the question came up of, was there a responsibility by the leadership of the Israeli army, who apparently were well aware that this was going to happen, that this was a real possibility that it's going to happen, and were in military control of the situation. And there was a whole dispute in Israel. On one side said one group of Arabs killed another group of Arabs, why are the Jews being blamed? And the other side said, you allowed a massacre to occur and you could have easily stopped it. So there was a dispute in the Israeli government whether to set up a commission of investigation. And at the time, the Mafdal, which was the name of the Zionist Party at that time, was in a critical position in terms of the votes in the cabinet, whether to proceed with it or not. And the Rav called Yosef Berg, who was the head of the party at the time, and said, I can't give you an exact quote, I wasn't in the room, but it was authenticated by many, never questioned, that if Mafdal doesn't vote to establish the commission of inquiry, I'm going to dissociate myself from the party and denounce the party. Right? And the Rav pointed out that his general policy was not to interfere in internal Israeli matters. I know in halakha questions in Israel, because I was in the room a number of occasions when people would ask him something and he would say, Israel has its own rabbinate. I don't mix it. The chief rabbinate in Israel. Here the Rav said, I'm mixing it. Now, if the Rav took this statement literally, right, that the Jews are allowed to kill the Palestinians because they hate all Jews, and that the status of Amalek, then why do I need an investigating committee if, because I allowed Arabs to do it? If I can do it myself, I can allow someone else to do it. So clearly he did. And that we know. Whether I'll raise a question, give my own answer, I can't claim it's the rough answer at all. And that is, well, how do we differentiate? Right? The Rebbe would suggest that the Rambam's notion that Israel can fight a defensive war being the Mechemet Mitzvah, even though we don't have a specific pasuk to that account that it's a mitzvah, right, is based on this notion of Amalek being on goal. Though you can come up with other explanations, it's a defensive war, you have to survive. Because one should ask a broader question. The Jews left Egypt. The Egyptians enslaved the Jews. Right? No one ever says this, we should have treat the Egyptians like a Amalek. The Torah is full of statements saying, don't mistreat Egyptians because you were, right, you were slaves in the land. Slaves in the land, we didn't come as slaves. They turned us into slaves. Nevertheless, we're not allowed to. The Shiva Sa'amim, obviously the separate mitzvah. Why do you need a separate mitzvah? Why not? They're Amalek, they're our enemy. The answer is that when someone fights against Israel, over an argument over something. For example, the Shiva Sa'amim were fighting over territory. That's not a Amalek. That's a war. You're fighting over territory. You're both claiming the same land. But that's not a Amalek. A Amalek is hatred. When the Nazis went to kill out the Jews, they went to kill the Jews out in Poland. What threat were the Jews in Poland? Let's even assume for argument's sake, for some bizarre reason, that they thought the Jews in Germany were traitors or whatever. So, it wasn't true, but they thought that. But why are they killing Jews in Russia? Why are they killing Jews in Poland? Even, you know, in Rhodes. What those Jews have to do? What threat were they to the Nazis? They had an ideology that involved hatred of Jews. It is not at all clear, even though I'm sure there are isolated elements who hate Jews, that the ideology, that the struggle over the land of Israel, broader land of Israel, whatever you want to put it, is not a fight over territory. Right? The Arabs say, we've been living here all these years. It's ours. You know, you came and took it from us, and we say, it's our heritage. Right? But that's not senseless hatred. That's a dispute that can lead to terrible things,
to war.
So it would seem to me that applying the notion of Amalek would only work if one made the assumption that the Arabs are out to kill our Jews. Now, we're not fighting over the land, they just want to kill our Jews. Now, I suspect that there were those who said so. We know that the history of Jews in Muslim countries was very complex. In some situations, the Muslims treated them a lot better than the Christians. In other situations, they didn't. Islam is a complex religion that has different elements within it. In fact, until the struggle in Israel, most people would have said the great danger to Israel, the ones we worry about are the Christians, right? We worry about the Christians, the accusers of killing their God, right? We discussed that a few chapters back. So, even though the Rav writes it, I am sure that the Rav didn't mean it in real terms. Why I describe it as dangerous, because people say, Rav Soloveitchik said, that the Arabs are Amalek. And therefore, if I kill an Arab 4-year-old, I'm allowed to, because he's going to grow up to be a terrorist. And he's going to grow up to hate, to hate all Jews. So I want to save the Rav from... I can't save him from what he wrote. What he wrote is what he wrote. But I can tell you that knowing his actions and his thoughts later on, he certainly didn't intend that he had to be taken in that kind of literal context. All right. Now, and I only have about 2 minutes or one, all right? We only have one more chapter to go. And we're going to talk about the Rav as a religious Zionist and why he sees religious Zionist responsibilities. I am sorry. 1 second. Okay. Why he sees religious Zionists having a specific responsibility for this. And that's because the non-Orthodox world, this guy doesn't get it. I'm going to shut this. He obviously wants to talk to me. The non-observant world, non-Orthodox world, the non-religious world, has the notion of faith, but not the notion of death. Right? And their bonds are therefore weaker bonds in the first place. People talk in Islam, and I don't like to get into politics, the secular Jews, they're going to leave. But they don't get it their way. They don't have the same level of commitment. I don't say that. I don't think it's true. But you can understand the argument that they don't have the same level of commitment to the nation and its land as those who are religiously based. On the other hand, in much of the Haredi world, only relates to the Jews that they accept as Jewish. And I don't mean only in the halakhic sense of people not having a Jewish mother or questioning the validity of conversions. I'm talking in the sense, of Jews who don't keep anything. Right? What kind of Jews are they? Right? Very often it becomes clear that the Haredi parties in Israel function to protect their community, right? And are willing to be part of the government, to not even express their views on other issues that don't directly focus on their community. But religious Zionists claim both, right? We on one hand, have the broader notion of the Jewish people, right? That is the covenant of faith sharing with the Jewish people. After all, the fundamental thing that differentiates the Zionism at its very outset was the willingness to function within the Zionist Congress, even though it was dominated by secular Jews. Right? And, of course, we stand for more. We stand for all of this stuff. We continue, then I'll finish off next.
Thank you.